listening to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I gotta tell you something, people. Back when I was a freshman, a sophomore, and a junior at Stockton State College in Pomona, New Jersey, every one of those years, Thompson Twins came out with an album. And our campus would just play it crazily. And you went to a party when Lies was on, everyone would sing the chorus. It was wonderful. And Hold Me Now was one of those songs that it was slow, but not real slow. So it led into the real slow song. So if you got someone to dance you with that, they're going to dance you with the slow songs, and you might get lucky. And the gentleman on my show today is responsible for all that. And my guest is Tom Bailey. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing well, thank you, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, I got to ask you, what is it like when you hear stories like that? Because I just turned 60, so my wife's 58. But Thompson Twins, the music you put together was a lot of our soundtrack to our lives. I mean, are those 80s. What was it? What is that like for you when you hear that from people?
Well, I mean, that's the way that it works, isn't it? And I think, you know, we all go through that period of life where we're breaking the rules that our parents set down for us, right? And whatever the soundtrack of those moments is, you know, the first time we stay out all night or maybe get a little bit tipsy or fall in love and have that first kiss and all those kind of things, whatever music is playing in the background becomes embedded in a kind of an emotional memory for us. And if the music is good, then it really stays and it hangs out. I think we all have that soundtrack of our early adulthood. And it's not exclusive. We obviously add things to it and take things away from it. But that's a good starting point for a love affair with pop music, for sure.
Well, it's funny. You're doing in the UK, you're doing a tour where you're celebrating 40 years of Into the Gap. And I put on Facebook, I always put an album that came out one day. And in February, I put that up. And it was funny to see how friends of mine were like, oh, yeah, we listened to it in the dorms and all that. And it just, you know, it really made a difference. But why did you decide to do this tour with playing that album and then playing other things? What is it, just because it was a 40-year anniversary?
I think the idea came up, yes, and it was, you know, an enormously big album for us. And it certainly broke us into territories around the world. So it became, you know, a kind of cultural object quite outside of our careers. And so the idea of looking at it and playing the whole thing, I think, is a promoter's dream come true. They love that because it sells tickets to fans, the real deep fans, you know, the ones that want to hear the forgotten tracks from side two of an album. And so when you say, yeah, we're going to play those things, it brings them along. But also from an artist's perspective, it's really great to be kind of forced into that retrospective view of your own work occasionally and say, hey, what were we thinking? Oh, I remember this and that and the other. And it's a very interesting experience for me. I was a little scared. I thought maybe there were, you know, some less than satisfactory pieces on side two of the album. But when I got back into playing them, I'm lucky. It's all good.
Well, you know, what is good? And the thing is also, it's a different time now. As I said, people my age and your age and a little bit younger, we were raised on albums. I mean, we would go to a store, you'd buy an album, and you'd look at it, and you go, oh, and if only one song was good, you go, oh, I got ripped off. I changed this money. But we would listen to it. So when you play it that way, I think it does, like you said, it really is great for your fans because they can just hear the whole album and that makes most people happy.
Yeah, it does. I mean, so much so that a lot of people want me to play it in the order that it was on the record, which I can't do for various kind of dramatic structural reasons. You know, I want to reorganize the order of songs in live performance. But you're right. It takes us back to a time when we would, as you say, buy an album and go back and listen to the whole thing rather than just cherry pick, which is the kind of current way of doing things because of streaming services. But anyway, I just think it's like reading an old diary for me. You know, it's just a fascinating way of saying, what the hell were we up to 40 years ago? And rediscovering that it was really interesting.
Now, when did you get involved in music? I believe you played piano when you were a kid. I mean, what gravitated you to this career? For me, you know, I ended up doing stand-up comedy for a while. And one of the reasons, I did it for 10 years, but one of the reasons was I sucked at music. My brother was good. I could not pick it up. But when did you decide that you wanted to play music? Were you a little kid, or how did this whole career get started?
Well, I mean, my father in particular was very musical. He was a doctor, you know, a physician, but music was very important to him. So he insisted that my two sisters and I all had music lessons and stuff. We became well-versed in that kind of childhood musical experience. But then I went to college and studied music there. And of course, once I was away from my parents' influence, I started to be a little bit more experimental. And I'd encountered all sorts of psychedelic music along the way, and it just became an obsession. You know? And so when the time came to get a kind of straight job or form a band, there was a big, big pull towards forming a band. And that's what I did. And it was, you know, the first few years were tough. We couldn't pay our way. We couldn't put food on the table and all the rest of it. So it takes a commitment in lifestyle because it is so hard. I don't know if bands do that so much these days because a lot of what we see, by the time it comes to the table, it's been constructed so immaculately by marketing experts and all the rest of it. You know, you don't know the nature of the hard yards that people have had to walk to get there. But I'm sure there's some element of that in every case. And it's one of the things that makes artists good, is the fact that it's not easy.
Well, that's what I always say. You know, it's like, I know a lot of actors, and even if they've had TV series, they're still going out in auditions. And people go, oh, that must suck. I'm like, well, it's not easy, because if it was easy, everybody would do it. Just like music. If music was easy, everybody could do it and make a hit record for you. You guys had a lot of hits, but if it was easy, if you didn't have talent, that wouldn't happen.
I think it's true that with luck, you develop skills also, you know, and develop a maturity about what you're attempting to do. But it's never, I mean, at the end of every album, you think, right, we solved so many problems making that album, the next one's going to be easy. And it never is. Because a new set of challenges come along.
Now,
some of those challenges actually undermine what you think you'd solved in the previous one. And isn't that great? You know, the fact that we move on, we encounter new ideas all the time.
Well, you know what I think also is very, like when I said when I was in college, those first 3 years, every year an album came out. So people don't get that you were touring and writing and working your ass off. And people don't understand that. They don't get, like, back in the 80s and early, people came out with albums every year. I mean, how did you keep the inspiration going? Because, you know, writing one song must be hard. Writing 10, 12, 14 must be a labor.
Well, I have to say that I don't really have an answer to that question, because I've never found inspiration a problem. You know, it's always there. And in a way, that surprises me. Like, I wake up every morning and I want to make music. It's just something I do. So more of a problem actually is writing lyrics. And, you know, back in the day, I wrote a lot of lyrics with Alana Curry, who was in the Thompson Twins. These days I do it on my own, and that can be the stumbling block, I think. You know, how can I find a new way of expressing the same old idea that everyone wants to write about? So, yeah, it is a struggle. But inspiration is never lacking. I always want to do it, that's the thing. You know?
And that's good. I think a lot of times as an artist, like for me, I get lazy. You know, I sit there and I want to write, and I'll come to my desk and I go, oh, my desk is cluttered, and I'll straighten it out instead of writing. I think a lot of times when you get inspired, you get a little scared because you're like, wow, that came pretty easy.
Yeah, we have artists have their own avoidance techniques, no doubt. But I mean, I think the point is, as you say, you've got to actually show up at the desk, right? If you don't show up at the desk, nothing gets done, that's for sure, not even the tidying. But by showing up, you make an agreement with yourself that your intention is to work and get on with it. And it's funny because there's no time clock. There's no one saying you're late. You have to do it through self-discipline.
Now, I want to go back to when Thompson Twins started. It was seven people in the beginning, I believe.
Well, went through various different formats. There was a four-piece period, then a seven-piece, and then it went down to three, which is the era that most people know us for. But yeah.
What was it like trying to get a record deal back then? I mean, was it easy to get, or what did you guys go through to get the deal?
It was actually difficult because we'd been through that kind of post-punk and new wave era where everyone was in a band, everyone wanted a record deal, and for a moment lots of record deals were just being handed out, you know, because it was also exciting in the UK anyway. It was also exciting to just have a go and see what happened. And then suddenly it became very difficult. The economy went into recession and the record companies pulled back, said, those days are over, we don't hand out record deals anymore. And so it took a lot of touring up and down the country, the same old story. You know, you have a little truck with your gear in the back and six people in the front driving away and sleeping on sofa and floors in friends' houses and stuff like that, and just to play a gig in some distant student town that would have you, you know. And as a result of that, you hone your craft, I guess, to the point where when you get back to one of the major cities and one of the lazy A&R guys from a record company comes along to see you, they go, wow, these guys are actually good. Maybe we should give them a record deal after all. So I think these days it doesn't work like that. There has to be a concept that is resolved, matured, and polished by marketeers before record companies get their hands on it. And at that stage, it's probably a fait accompli, and then a lot of time and resources have been spent on getting it to that point.
Now, once you got that first deal, tell me what happened. How did you get to the success level? I mean, was it a long, you worked your ass off, as you said, you got tight, you got your chops on the road. So when you're ready, you're ready to do it. Tell me about when you first started feeling some success.
Well, we had been a kind of larger guitar, drums, bass-based band, playing experimental student rock, you might say. And then at the end of the second album that we made in that format, we ran out of material. And I just, at that point, scraped enough money together to buy a synthesizer. And there was a drum machine kicking around in the studio. So I said, don't worry, guys, we have enough material because I'm going to write something on the synthesizer. And it will pad out side two rather nicely. And what happened was that night I wrote a song called In the Name of Love, which went on to be an enormous club and dance hit in around the world, and especially in America. So it kind of embarrassed us into changing direction. We realized that, or at least I realized, that's what I wanted to do creatively. And I think the people around me said, ooh, this is, the signpost is all in this direction. It's no longer as a kind of experimental guitar band. And so that led us to reduce to a three-piece and make an album which was entirely synthesizer and drum machine based. And it was part of something that was happening in the UK at the time, that kind of synth-pop revolution. So technology had a lot to do with it. We were able to make records as I keep saying this, you know, when I talk about it, I say that we were designers of pop records rather than a band playing music. And that somehow changed everything, and we started having hits. And suddenly, one day, you know, someone tells you, whoop, here we go, fasten your safety belts, because, you know, records start zooming up the charts. And that feeling, that kind of giddy feeling of excitement that hits you when that happens, as someone said at the time, it only happens once, and you have to get used to it and deal with it. Because it can be very destabilizing, or it can be the thing you've been looking forward to. And because of that long time I told you about, driving up and down the motorways of the UK to play student gigs, we were ready for it. You
know? Now, what was it like when you, how many times did you guys do Top of the Pops? Because, you know, I try to tell people that was like the show. Like, in America, it was a Tonight Show. Like, if a stand-up comedian did the Tonight Show, their career changed overnight. They had Hollywood calling them and going, put your, when was the first time you guys did Top of the Pops?
I actually can't remember the first time and what the song was. It was probably Lies, I would say. No, it wasn't. It was Love on Your Side. It became a massive UK hit, that song. And the thing about Top of the Pops was, it was that moment in everyone's local history where you gathered around the TV set on a Thursday night and watched Top of the Pops. Sometimes with several generations in the same room, you know, so there'd be kids, parents and grandparents all looking at this thing. And the grandparents would be saying, this is disgusting. The parents would be saying, music isn't what it used to be. And the kids were going, right on. So it was this moment of collective disagreement about what was happening in culture. You know? So fantastically interesting. And they regularly had viewerships of 15 to 20 million people, which for the UK made it the biggest show of all time. And the thing is, if a tiny proportion, even if 1 or 2% of the people who watched you on that show went out and bought the record the next day, that was it. You were made into success. So we don't have those kind of influential moments in culture these days. But yeah, you're absolutely right to pick on that as an important thing. A similar thing happened in the US when MTV suddenly arrived and said to us, hey, we want some kind of wacky stuff from the UK. Have you got anything? And we ended up with an opening into the US through MTV. And they played Lies, I think, off that record to begin with.
MTV, just so you know, and I was someone who watched it religiously, and we watched it in college, they would program stuff. Like, you would hear when a video was going to come on, and you would watch it, and it turned on so many of us who grew up with older brothers who played classic rock and stuff like that to a whole new work of bands of UK. Now, what was your experience shooting the videos? Because I've been on movie sets. They're a pain in the ass. You sit around a lot. You don't know. Tell me what your first video. Do you remember the first video? Was it Lies, the first video you shot?
I think it probably was. Of course, the first shock is that they want you there at 6 in the morning, which for musicians is unheard of. You know? 6 in the morning? Well, we've only just got home from the last night's gig, you know. And so it's a long, hard day. You sit there munching snacks at the catering table and waiting for your moment. But of course, in those early days of video, it was a massively interesting and creative excitement to do that kind of thing. I think it became a little bit tedious after a while. Because it was so powerful, I think it got to the stage where more money was being spent on the videos and on the records. And I found myself thinking, you know, to be a video pinup, you know, I'm a musician. I want to make music. That's the center of my interest. The core of my interest is in music. So you do things to support that interest, but it can't take over from the centrally important idea of music, for me anyway.
So as you're getting bigger, you're getting hits. I know you went out on the road with the Police, right?
Oh, yeah, we did a fantastic tour with the Police. They were at the peak of their careers, and I think at the peak of their internal dispute as well. So it was a very interesting time to be on tour. they were arriving in separate limos, put it that way.
What was that like for you, though? Because all of a sudden, you know, you're playing great venues. I mean, as you said, you had played these gigs to get to the point, and now you're feeling, you're reaping your success. You know, you're sitting there, and you're not the headliner, but you're playing, opening for one of the, at the time, one of the biggest bands in the world. So what did that do for you? Because you're the front man. How do you go from playing a small club to a bigger club? Is it something that you have to, it gets you nervous at first, or is it just something that, because you're a performer and you're a musician, you're ready? Well,
it was certainly frightening, you know. I mean, I think one of the first gigs we played with them was Hollywood Racetrack, 90,000 people, you know. And that kind of event for anyone can raise fear. But the thing is, I think as performers, you learn to deal with that. You learn to grasp it by the throat and say, right, what are we going to do with this situation? You know, and it was very, very nice to be invited to do those things at that point in our career. It kind of elevated us, you're right, a few rungs on the ladder, but it also gave us a clue as to what maybe lay in the future. Something to reach out and aim for, you know, that level of success. And we probably only achieved that here and there, not as globally as the Police, but yeah, you get a glimpse of what the big time is all about.
Now, what's the pressure when you have the first album that has some success, you know, a commercial album, and then, you know, you're the trio now, and you're coming out next with Into the Gap. I mean, what's the pressure on you? Because it's, when you're touring, you get your morning radio, this, that. It's not like everyone thinks, oh yeah, we're just going out, we're drinking and we're going crazy. You're on a bus, you're going promotion. How did you get the writing accomplished when you were on the road? Because you have a lot going on, and I'm sure the studios are wanting hits. They want to come out with, you know, your next album better be something.
Right. Well, we more or less replicated the practice of our previous album, which had done well for us. So we said, okay, let's go into a writing session where we get out of London, where there are too many distractions, too many parties, too many friends calling around and all that kind of, let's go. So we rent a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, you know, and make it difficult to do anything other than write songs. And then we treat it like an important job, and we thought we won't leave this place until we've got what we think is a handful of really great songs. We can add the others later, maybe, or we can be kind of sketchy about those and fill in the gaps, but we're not going to go into a studio and start work on this album until we've got something really good. Now, and I think we did that in a couple of places, and in the earlier writing session, Alana and I had some kind of argument, which was resolved by writing Hold Me Now. A kind of weird thing, but there you go. And the way that kind of tracked out was that by the time we got to make the Into the Gap album, we'd already finished and released Hold Me Now. So that put an enormous pressure on us. It was zooming up the charts everywhere in the world and doing really well. It was very, very exciting. And that made us realize we had to make this album brilliant. Otherwise, it would be the biggest failed opportunity of all time. And I really enjoyed that pressure. And so we were able, and I think it kind of coincided with a certain, like, you develop skills, you develop some maturity in your songwriting process, and it came to fruition on that record. So.
Now, you know, you'd said earlier that Alana did some of the lyrics, a lot of the lyrics, you did music. Did you have a concept for the song? So like Doctor Doctor, when you sit down to write that, you do the music. Does Alana come to you with lyrics, or do you have a concept of what it's going to be? How did you write Doctor Doctor? Because that's a great song and it's very popular. What was the method?
Well, I mean, if you spoke to Alana and asked her the same question, you'd probably get two different answers. I think that Doctor Doctor is one of the songs where she wrote most of the lyrics for sure. And I think she was probably just exploiting that tradition of love as an illness kind of song, a bad case of loving you kind of tradition. And it had particular resonance with me because my family are all doctors. And I was actually not getting on with my family very well at the time. And so it seemed to me that it was partly about that, or rather, I interpreted it in my own way. So much so that I think we probably have, as I say, very different views of what it means. But I also remember just writing, because we had this strict kind of division of labor. She would write lyrics, I would do all the music. Joe was working on the stage show, really, during the album, thinking how we were going to perform this. And Alana also did the visual elements of photography and video and what have you. But I was Mr. Music, if you like. And I remember this song, Doctor Doctor, starting off with a very, very kind of machine-like synthesizer riff. And on its own, it already sounded like a hit to me and to Alex Atkin, our producer. Wow, this sounds amazing. And at that stage, he, for example, had no idea what the lyrics were going to be. It just was a piece of music that we were building up in the studio. So, I mean, that's a glimpse into how you don't normally have a fully resolved and overarching concept of what you're doing. It emerges in the process of doing it. And I mean, I knew what it was going to be about because we'd recorded the demo in our farm, getaway farmhouse somewhere in the English countryside. But yeah, you have to leave the door open for happenstance, for the creative circumstances to just deliver something wonderful on a plate as you're working.
Was there any song that you sat down and you started it off one way, maybe a riff or something, but then it went completely a different way, and you were like, holy crap, this is great?
Well, I think lots are like that, to be honest. I mean, you start with anything, it almost doesn't matter. And in fact, I think that's good advice for people who have some kind of block or are stuck. Just start with anything. That's not the problem. It's what you do with it is the problem. So I would say start with anything, break as many rules as you can in the first half an hour. Surprise yourself with all these challenges, and then automatically something interesting will happen. You may then need, you may have created a wild beast that you need to tame. So that's another problem, that's another issue. And many, many times I get the feeling that that's what goes on. You start up with something that's wild and interesting, and then you resolve it into something more acceptable. And at that point you go, wow, I'm onto something here. And sometimes that turns out to be true. And it's a wonderfully rewarding process. So, yeah.
Now, the second album's a huge hit. So, what's the pressure for the third album to be a huge hit? Is it there? Do you feel it?
We're talking about future days. Well, yes, there was pressure, and we've been touring so much that we our normal routine of having the time to go away and write songs and all the rest of it had broken down a bit. We ended up going to Paris and cutting basic tracks there. I was producing, and it got to the stage where we were running two studios simultaneously in Paris, and I was kind of running between two of them, and it got crazy. And I said, oh, you know what? This is not fun anymore. I don't want to do this. And so we took a break and recommenced in New York with Nile Rodgers, who agreed to jump on the album halfway through its creation, which is good because I mean, as a producer, normally you want to be there from the beginning to help with some of the kind of defining decisions. But he was happy to do that. He heard the material and said, well, it's, you know, it's halfway there. Let's just finish it off as well as we can. And which is what we did. And that's how we ended up in New York finishing Future Days. And I got to say, he took some of the pressure off my shoulders as well to make the album a success. And he brought in all sorts of interesting ideas. And when it came to, because in the middle of that we had the Live Aid problem, you know, how are we going to do Live Aid? We're in New York making an album. And so we said, okay, let's do it in Philadelphia. And but we have no band. And then Niall says, well, you know what, I think David Letterman's band have got the night off because Live Aid's on. And so David Letterman's show is cancelled. And he made the call, and suddenly we have a, you know, like one of the most famous current bands in America playing for us. And Steve Stevens, the guitarist from Billy Idol's band, had played in the initial sessions in Paris. He came over and played on a few tracks. So I said, come along and do Live Aid. He was keen to do that because Billy wasn't doing it. Who else? Of course, Madonna had just worked with Niall, and it felt like she needed a break.
I wanted to ask you about Live Aid. It's funny, I watched the video today because Live Aid is one of the concerts that I was down the beach and I didn't get tickets. And my wife now said she was down the beach and someone had tickets, but there's no cell phone, so they couldn't call her and say, hey, we got tickets to the show. I've talked to so many people about Live Aid. Tell me your experience with it. I've heard both sides. I mean, Kenny Jones told me the side over in Wembley. I've heard different people's stories in Philly. What was it like for you? Because, first of all, that stadium is huge. JFK, and it's a raucous place. It gets loud and it gets rowdy. How did Live Aid, did they approach you and say, come do Live Aid, or what happened?
Oh, I've no idea, because that would have been a conversation between the Live Aid planners and our management. But obviously there was some negotiation where we said, we can't do it in the UK, can we do it in Philadelphia? And they said, okay, we'll make that happen for you. And of course, therefore we were outsiders. We weren't part of the local scene. I didn't know a lot of the other musicians because they were predominantly from North America. But it was great fun, you know, and an incredibly exciting event. Almost to the point of freaking everyone out, you know, because it was a big audience. Again, 90,000, I think, in the stadium. But the freaky thing was that that audience was dwarfed by the number of people watching on TV around the world, and that can kind of that can make you nervous, because there's no second take in that situation. Right? You have to get it right. But it is also one of those moments which is relentless. You know, there's no holding back. You just have to go with the flow and get it done and enjoy it. And it was incredibly exciting. So exciting and so brilliant that, in fact, it was that became a kind of watershed moment for pop culture, because it was difficult to do anything better than that after Live Aid. And so, I don't know, in some ways, the whole of pop culture was a little bit of an anticlimax after that moment. It had been the crowning achievement of everything that pop music and MTV and radio and TV had led up to, that being a possibility.
Now, did you choose the two songs? Because did you decide what you guys were going to play?
In fact, we chose more. We were told we could play three songs and we had a certain amount of time. And at the last minute, the band before us went on too long. So they said to us, sorry, guys, you're going to have to cut a song. And I remember making that decision, you know, behind the curtain, more or less. Okay, we'll just go with two songs. And we chose those two out of the three. I think the third one was a song no one had ever heard of before, because it was on our new album. So probably a good decision anyway. And it was great fun.
Now, after the third album, you did the song Nothing in Common for the Tom Hanks Jackie Gleason movie. That seemed more guitar. You seemed to put more guitar into that. Did you feel a shift in the music right then? Because it was more, to me, when I was listening to it, it's a little more guitar oriented than your other songs.
Yes, well, I think you're probably right. The context of popular music was going that way a little bit as well. Guitars were back in. I mean, two albums before that, we made an album with no guitars at all on it. So it's partly as a kind of fashion and style decision, but it's also, as a creative enterprise, you discover things by limiting your palette. And I think we did that to discover what we wanted to do as songwriters, to do, okay, it's going to be just synthesizers, drum machines, and a bit of percussion on the side. And as we became more confident and relaxed about our production technique, we invited more of the more widely used instruments like guitars and pianos and things back into our sound. And having done that, we thought, what's the big deal? We can go fully in the other direction if we want to. But I think maybe it's the way it was produced, that record as well. Rupert Hine produced, and he was happy to have louder guitars.
So what happened to the band? What happened to Thompson Twins?
In what respect? You mean, well,
why'd you stop playing together? I mean, you grew tired of each other, or was just something you had different views of which way you wanted to go? Because everyone forgets, you have this huge success, and you're all pretty young. And most people don't get that kind of success when they're in their, 20s, 30s. You have giant success. But what happened? Did you guys just grow apart, or what happened?
Well, I suppose you're right, yeah. But it took place over a long period of time, because... Like, it wasn't one day when we just had a big argument and decided to quit or anything. Joe left after Future Days, and it was Alana and myself for the next three albums, I think. And then even after that, we thought, you know what, we need to rediscover our experimental roots. And the record company and the audience doesn't really want us to do that. So we'll change our name and do a different project, which is called Babel. And we made two albums after the Thompson Twins under the name Babel. And, one of which is very good, I think. But so we kind of maneuvered away from that spotlight of fame and fortune and back into the underground to kind of rediscover the creative challenges of all that. The other thing, of course, that happened was that MTV had become so big that videos were the most powerful tool. And so Alana in particular said, I don't want to tour anymore because we can just make videos. You know, we make records, we make videos. Why do we need to slog around the world? I didn't really agree with that, but I couldn't force her to tour if she didn't want to. So it ended up being something we didn't do. And I think at that point we became, in a certain sense, non-current, because we weren't about to show up in people's backyards. We'd become distant and untouchable again. So maybe it was a life-saving move on her part, because she really... I mean, we had kids as well at that point, so we didn't want to be in the back of a bus with two young kids.
Now, how hard is it getting recognized all the time? Because you guys are a different look. You had the great hair. Yeah, you had the big hair, and then you dressed cool. I mean, we always, in America, we try to sit there and go, why can't we find clothes like that at Macy's? People, like, because we don't sell it at Macy's. But what was it like for you when you started getting recognized? Is it a little bit overwhelming, and do you ever get used to it?
It is overwhelming. You do get used to it, and sometimes you even crave it. You know, like, you walk down the street and no one recognizes you. What's going on, guys? So it's a weird game you play with yourself, I think. The price of fame is sometimes worth paying, and sometimes it's Sometimes the check is too high, but I don't know. It was a particularly flamboyant fashion moment, wasn't it? The 80s, we kind of looked pretty outrageous. And of course, I don't get recognized these days because I'm not on TV all the time. I mean, I think that's the main thing, is if you're on TV the day before, then you can't walk down the street the day after.
Now, I saw you when I lived in LA. I saw you at the Retro Futura tour at the Greek. And I was
Oh, yeah.
there, and I was with my wife. She wasn't my wife then. And a guy from When in Rome named Clive Farrington. He had tickets, so he had me go. And it was a great show. But before that, you had not played Thompson Twins music in like 27 years, right? So what made you decide just to stop?
Well, it was that decision not to tour anymore that Alana had come up with and insisted upon, and it just became habit. And then eventually she wanted to kind of close everything down and say, we're not going to do this anymore. When we moved to New Zealand, I started up with other projects, making my dub project, International Observer, and my Indian music project. And I thought, yeah, this is fine. I put all these things to one side for so long because I was too busy with mainstream pop music. Why not give yourself the enjoyment with this new life you're forming in New Zealand and give yourself time to examine these labors of love? They're not going to make you any money or fame. They're just things you do because it's the right thing to do. And as a result, I had not the slightest intention of ever getting on a stage again with pop music. And that became a firm decision. It lasted for 27 years. And even if I had the occasional temptation, I just resisted it, you know.
Is that
And
hard
then
though?
one.
Was that hard to resist? Because you have to. I mean, okay. And I know this because I didn't do comedy for a long time, and I got back in it. And I do it now occasionally. And when I get off, oh, it feels great. But then I'm like, yeah, I don't feel like going through the shit of getting on stage. But for you knew that when you if you went on stage, and as soon as you started playing Doctor Doctor or whatever, the crowd's going to go crazy, and you it's a given. So did you miss that? I mean, it's something that it's just that. The adulation, the saying, we approve of your work, this is great.
You know, the truth is, I think I'd forgotten that response would be there. And I was very nervous about ever doing it. I'd just written it off as a possibility. And then one thing led to another. So, actually, a Mexican artist, Alex Syntek, was making an album where he wanted to write with all his childhood heroes. And I, along with a lot of people from the 80s, were his childhood heroes. So he invited me to. I did it, and I enjoyed it so immensely, writing and making this record of him, that I thought, what have I been kidding myself about pop music? And I really dig it. There's something really, even though I do all these other things, it has a special place in my heart. So, how strange that I've spent 27 years denying that. And almost while I'm in this frame of mind, I get a phone call from Howard Jones saying, I want to tour in America. We're putting a bill together. Would you come and do it? You know, and like 3 days earlier, I would have just said no instinctively. But because I was in this frame of mind, having worked with Alex Syntek, I said, well, maybe, you know. And I was not ready for it at all, but I kind of crossed the line back into pop music and had to organize a band, a management, and crew, and all these kind of things, like as if I was starting from scratch. But the weird thing was, it was kind of easier than ever before because you were doing it maybe with a little bit of wisdom of past experience, you know. And I wasn't trying to prove anything, I was just doing it for enjoyment.
Did all the songs come back to you very quick, or did you have to sit there and remember? Because it's like anything. If you don't do something for 27 years, I know they're in your head, you play it a lot, but when you do it, when your mind is going different places, you lose that span.
Well, I mean, I've told this story before, but I didn't have the Thompson Twins CDs. So, and I had one on a shelf. I pulled it out and it was empty. You know, someone had taken the CD out of it and replaced it. So I actually had to go into town in London and buy one of my own records, bring it back, And actually, on the way back, sitting in the car, I was just looking at the track list and making a mental list. Yeah, I'm going to play that one, that one, that one, not that one, but I'll do this one and this one. And it was really obvious what I had to do. Because at that stage, if you are trying to evoke some sense of the past, you know, and retrospectively examining your best work, that's the stuff you want to do. You know? It was really obvious. So I went home and I made new arrangements of these old songs, which were necessarily contemporarized by the way that I work now, but very recognizable as the songs that people knew. And I put a band together and said, these are the parts you've got to play, let's do it. And we rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And I was still nervous. So the first gig we were going to do was this enormous festival. And I thought, that's just too heavy, man. Let's do a warm-up show in some little club somewhere, which we did. And I made a piece of music, an instrumental version of one of the Thompson Twins songs that we weren't going to perform that night. I used that as a kind of intro piece of music. And the crowd just sang all the words. And I realized at that moment exactly what you said earlier, that there was just going to be this massive response, that the songs, in fact, do half the work for me, and the audience does the other half.
Now, you're going to be also, after you play the 40-year of Into the Gap, you're at the totally Tubular Festival. So how long will your sets be with that? Because you're co-headlining that with Thomas Dolby, I believe.
That's right. They won't be as long as the 40th anniversary show, because, I mean, those shows are my own, and I get to play as long as I want. On a festival, you get a time slot allotted to you, and you have to fit it in. And that will be, you know, it'll be a greatest hit show for sure, because with a festival audience, not everyone is your fan. You know, they're fans of all the other bands as well. And they're more likely to respond and enjoy hearing the songs they know rather than the deep cuts. So, yeah, we'll be doing a shorter and more hit-intensive
set. I want to ask you about one song, because if you were here, it was on the 16 Candles soundtrack, and people watch that movie over and over, and the song fits the last scene perfectly. I'm sure they came and got that from you. John Hughes would do that. But were you surprised when all of a sudden that became pretty much like a underground pop culture hit?
Yes, because it was never released as a single, so I guess it could have been, but we had other more prominent songs that took that space. It was never released as a single, but became a big cultural hit in America. Not so much in the UK, because people didn't watch that movie. Well, the movie wasn't such a big event. Yes, I love that song. I love playing it. And it's an essential for the US set list. Not so much in the UK. But no, I really love it. It's also one of those songs where I felt that I had a kind of complete involvement in its writing. I think I wrote the words for that song as well. And although all those Thompson Twins hits are credited to the three of us, the amount that people actually did was, you know, varied from song to song. And it's a bit like the Lennon-McCartney situation. You have to kind of guess who is in charge in any given moment. But, yeah, a great song, and I love it. In fact, I even wrote extra verses. So for the live version, it has two extra verses in it.
Okay, before we go, I want you to look back at your career and just give me a few things that you're really proud of, like a highlight and something you're really proud of, because you've touched a lot of people with your music. You've had a great career. You've been successful. I mean, as I said, you can come back now after being 27 years away and people still want to see you. A lot of times people go, he's been gone. But what's something that really, give me something that was a highlight of your career and then something that makes you really proud about your career.
Well, pride is a concept that I have difficulty with, to be honest, because You know, a lot of it is just turning up and crossing your fingers, hoping for the best. And with a bit of luck, things start happening. But I think if you are hardworking and persistent, eventually you're going to land on something good. I mean, if there's a little bit of talent there as well, then it all helps. But songs like Hold Me Now arise out of circumstance and end up being the thing that carries a band through its career. And that's never more obvious than when I'm on stage. And I usually sing it last song of the night. And I invite the audience to sing along. And it's this wonderful emotional moment that shows that none of those 40 years was wasted. It was all worth doing. And if I have a kind of tear of sadness, metaphorically, it's that back in the day, we still thought that music had this inherent power and responsibility to make the world a better place. You know, I mean, Live Aid was a great kind of physical example of that. We thought we were going to improve a terrible, tragic situation, which we did. These days, I think that burden of rock and roll has dissipated into fame and fortune. Celebrity is the aim of rock and roll now, not making the world a better place. And so I miss that. But every time I play Hold Me Now and see people singing it back at me, it reminds me of how great those motives are and that music still has the power.
How long will you be touring for? I mean, how long do you want to keep this going? I mean, you know, it's you did the Future Retour, then you did a tour like 2 years ago, what, 6 years ago. It's been 6 years since you came to the States. Are you going to make us wait that long again? Are you going to come and do it, and then we're going to sit there and go, oh, you know, we want them to come back?
Well, I won't say that I want to die with a guitar strap over my shoulder or anything like that. But as long as it's fun and goes on, then why not? I mean, in fact, we've had a couple of cancellations for strategic reasons on this year's schedule that have already been bounced back to the year after. So, you know, that means I can't retire. So there you go. It just keeps rolling on.
Well, I want to thank you for coming on, Tom. I'm a big fan, and it's so funny. It's daytime there. It's dinner time here. And so the tour, are you looking forward to Into the Gap? Are you ready? Are you feeling good about the 40-year celebration?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's going to be fantastic. I have a great band, great crew, and the audiences are wonderful. So, yeah, what's not to like?
So, people, go look up Tom Bailey. When he's in America, stop by, go see the show. I might go see him in Atlantic City. It's about an hour drive, but I'll go down to see Tom. It's a great bill. It's got Thomas Dolby and a few other people. And go listen to Thompson Twins. If you haven't listened to them lately, listen to it. And also go watch 16 Candles and just look how perfectly placed that song is when Jake Ryan is sitting there with Sammy and they're having their birthday gig. So anyway, I want to thank you, Tom. People, go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 999 episodes. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Twitter, it's at coopertalk. Instagram, I'm at coopertalk1. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.